Hi, I'm Jim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach podcast, episode 26 of the New Republic. Of course, you can find us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Grierson, I got a couple news items for us before we get going this week. Something that we should warn the listeners about right now. Two things before we get going. We got a lot to get to on this podcast. It's a big movie week. Number one, because of some personnel stuff going on at the New Republic, we mentioned earlier we lost our producer, Michaela LaFrac. This week, I am actually producing this podcast. Now, Grierson, this is a terrifying notion because this is the first podcast I've ever produced. So if in the middle of it, all of a sudden, just like you hear like Mussolini or like some sort of dying animal, that's a mistake. I don't know what I'm doing yet. So I'm doing the best I can here. So can you bear with me, Grierson?
I'm just going to talk very slowly. So it'll be fine.
All right. Well, fair enough. And the second thing to keep in mind, so just bear with me on this. We're under construction. Remember back in the days, Grierson, back when the early days of websites, when there'd be that little guy on like a, we're under construction. He'd have a hard hat.
he had a hard hat or maybe a mop. Yes. Or like, and he was always kind of befuddled by what was going on. He was confused.
And it was early GIF. It was like an early GIF that they would put together back in the day. So that's kind of what the podcast is. I think hopefully it sounds fine. Hopefully it will be relatively seamless. This week it may be slightly less seamless, but eventually when I am not in the middle of the place, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, it will be a lot more seamless. I am already starting to get this mastered, but give me a couple weeks. The second thing is one of the reasons I'm under a bit of a time crunch this week is I am in Cleveland, Ohio, covering the Republican National Convention for Bloomberg Politics on one of my side gigs. So if you hear a police siren behind me or some sort of protest or just the braying of an orange jackass, know that I apologize. I'm just in Cleveland covering the convention.
And you just arrived like today, actually.
So I just arrived today.
You are freshly arrived in Cleveland.
Yes, it's a fun, stable place to be right now. Let me tell you that right now. But we're going to talk about happy things. We're going to talk about movies. We have two movies to get to this week, the two big releases of the week. Also, if you remember a couple of weeks ago, we did our top six movies of the first half of 2016. Now, ordinarily, I will not change this list. There's a whole second half of 2016. However, there's a movie that we have discussed on this podcast, or Grierson has discussed on this podcast that I have not, that I just recently saw that is from the first half of 2016 that I'd like to just very briefly talk about how much I enjoyed it and how much I want to put it on the list. Grierson, you don't know what this movie is yet, do you?
I actually know what it is.
How did you just, because you've guessed it?
Well, it's Warcraft, right?
Orcs! It's not Warcraft. We discussed it. No, this movie I had not seen it. It's not Warcraft. So we're going to discuss briefly that movie because we didn't get a chance to talk about it, and I really loved it. But first off, we're going to we remind you, as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice review on iTunes. It gives us a chance, gives people a chance to find the podcast. And if you leave a positive review and the name of a movie that you'd like us to talk about, we will read your review and talk about your movie in our reboot section. This week, the reboot review comes to us from Scoot Diggity. Is that the guy that played the guy in Batman vs Superman that got his legs crushed? That blew up the Holly Hunter with the vial of warm piss.
That was Scoot McNary.
Yeah, Scoot Diggity. That's the street name. Scoot Diggity.
Wow.
Yeah, so Scoot Diggity on April 14, 2016. Says, subject line, they make me want to see movies. Here is his quote. Grierson is like the genetically perfect son, born to fulfill society's needs because his parents loved him and wanted him to be perfect. Leach, however, is only perfect because of his will to overcome his imperfection. How ironic that his flawed heart beats stronger than any other as he pursues his goals. Or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway, Gattaca. So we're going to talk about Gattaca, which is he very, very cleverly kind of mapped out the plot of Gattaca. So in our reboot section, we'll be talking about Gattaca. But first off, we need to talk about Ghostbusters.
Yes, Ghostbusters, as you may have heard, is a remake directed by Paul Feig, starring, women. And those women happen to be Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, Kristen Wiig, and Leslie Jones. This movie, Ghostbusters, exists in a world where the original Ghostbusters from 1984 never actually happened. So it's set in present-day New York, where this group of women, some who know each other from before, Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy, are old friends who had falling outs, but reunite and team up with Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon to battle ghosts in New York City. But don't worry, all you fans of the original film, because many of the actors from the original film will show up to do cameos in this new movie. So to kind of kick us off here, Will, I think that it's safe to say that we both feel the same way going into this movie, which was we don't care at all about people who are hurt that their childhood has been ruined because there's a new...
There's no way those people's childhood was not already ruined.
Yes, and also, we also felt the same way that we were rooting for this movie, but at the same time, very troubled by the first trailer. I mean, what's funny about like those initial trailers for this movie is that even people like me who are really looking forward to this movie thought, this doesn't look as funny as I sort of hoped it would be. But I kind of usually subscribe to the theory that a trailer, I don't care. I'm going to just kind of hold out hope that the movie will end up being good.
Grierson, do you think it's good?
I do think it's good. I have not had the sensation since seeing Star Wars Force Awakens where the first 10 minutes of a movie, I just sort of sat there just nervous, just thinking, I hope this is good. I hope this is good. And for very different reasons. I mean, Star Wars, I just kind of felt like I would like for, you know, because we're going to be getting several of these new Star Wars movies, I just wanted it to be good for my future film going. Ghostbusters, I will admit, there was a little bit more of a vested interest in. I would like this to be good for the people involved. I like all four actresses. I like Paul Feig. He's just coming off of Spy, which is my favorite of his movies that he has done. About 10 minutes into it, I finally kind of breathed a sigh of relief and said, okay, this is perfectly good. I can just relax and just enjoy the rest of it. I have a lot of thoughts. And I kind of want to, but I'll start off by saying, I think that it's pretty consistently funny. I think it's pretty charming. The four actresses are really enjoyable together. I think it is a little more slack than I would like. It definitely feels like a movie where there were certain scenes that were not finished, and they just said, you're all funny. Why don't you improv this? And we'll just kind of cut around you four funny ladies, which I don't think works very well very often. I think that's very true in this movie. But that all being said, there's enough like consistently funny stuff in this movie that I found myself enjoying it. I do have quibbles that we'll get to in a second, but to kind of get the ball rolling, I think if people are worried, is this movie actually going to like work? Yes, it definitely does.
All right. Well, yeah, I, like you, was not only rooting for this movie, but was very excited about it. Not because like I need to like win some sort of culture war against dumbasses, but more that I really like Paul Feig and Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy working together. I love Spy. I actually like Bridesmaids even more. Like, I really think those are both terrific movies, which is why I was kind of disappointed that I didn't like Ghostbusters very much. I have to say, this is not a fun movie not to like. I will confess, this is a movie that I found myself cheering for. It's not a disaster. It's not a mess. And certainly, the leads are not the problem. Like, the Ghostbusters are definitely not the problem. The problem is this weird sense that the movie has that it needs to somehow please old Ghostbusters fans. I feel like every single time there is a nod to the old Ghostbusters movie, the movie stops dead in its tracks. Whether it's a here's a joke about how they look they're going to be at the old fireman stations. Nope, they're at this other Chinese restaurant. And the cameos, Grierson, every cameo in this movie by someone that shows up from the old movie not only stops it dead in its track, but made me think that they did no desire to actually do this. The Bill Murray cameo is awful. The Dan Aykroyd cameo, it's right in the middle of a really important part of the movie that didn't just like the movie, the needle comes screeching off the record. There's just not, and the problem is there's these nods to the original movie, but they're not really relevant and they're not really interesting, and they take away from what I think is good in this movie, which are not only the four leads, who I think are actually more charming and work together maybe more than they're funny. I think Kate McKinnon is definitely the fun. I think she's clearly the highlight of the cast. I don't think that she's so much as like drop dead hilarious as much as she is just doing something kind of interesting and being a little weird in the role that I think the movie like works when it really is kind of trying to capture her energy. But this is not a particularly fun Kristen Wiig performance. That's not a particularly fun Melissa McCarthy performance. They're both very likable, but are they really that funny in the movie? I don't mean that like they try to be funny and fail. I mean the movie kind of straps both of them with this kind of dull thing to do. And to me, that was the issue with the movie, is that every time it tries to capture the spirit of the original, it kind of flops and maybe just want to get right back to them. But again, they're not given enough funny to do. So you kind of like glide off their good cheer and off their, and how much fun it is to be around all of them. But I have to say, the villain in this is super lame, like super lame. The plot is really nothing. Like the plot is there are ghosts now, and here they come, and that's what's happening. Is an incredibly lame villain. The special effects are good, but the last half hour of this movie is just this very uninspired action sequence, to be entirely honest. And even some of the big, like, supposed fight scenes and big special effects heavy stuff is really not particularly exciting, and there's not even a lot of logic to him. I would have loved, I'd read a lot in kind of the work up to the movie about how they were really going to steer into the skid on the, we're going to, like, this is going to mock those jerk guys that were downvoting this on YouTube, and there's going to be this thing that really sticks it to them. And there's like a couple lines, but there's really not that much of that. And I feel like this movie really needs to justify its existence more than it does. Like, basically, this is, we made a Ghostbusters movie, except we use these four funny women rather than four funny men. And to me, like, what's the movie, Grierson, the really bad movie with Ben Stiller and Jack Black, where they're like, Neighborhood Watch?
Oh, The Watch, yes.
The Watch, yes. That is, that, like, it's, I read some stuff saying, hey, you know what, there already was an all-male Ghostbusters movie, and it was The Watch, and it was terrible. And it is absolutely true that, like, but this doesn't feel, in a lot of ways, this doesn't feel like this very strong, like, oh, now they're women Ghostbusters. What does that mean? It doesn't really do much in it. They're all kind of just charming, but they never veers into that. I would have loved to have seen more of a almost a challenge of the first movie than necessarily kind of a recitation of it. So, I still think there's a lot to like this movie. Everyone's very likable in it, but I just don't think it's particularly inspired. And I think as an actual movie, I'm not sure it works.
Yeah, I understand it not being as inspired, because I agree with that. The problem that this movie has, and going back to the Star Wars Force Awakens comparison, is that they both have that thing of fan service. And I agree that the cameos in this movie, the Bill Murray one doesn't bother me. The Dan Aykroyd one is just excruciating. Mm-hmm. Excruciating. I will say that the for people who have not yet seen the movie, I won't spoil it, but there is a cameo that shows up that happens during the credits. I think is actually pretty great. That I think actually is funny. Mm-hmm. But most of the cameos and the callbacks and the references do get in the way. I completely agree with that. I don't mind so much, and this actually gets to the heart of what I like about the movie. I actually don't mind the fact that this movie is not as outright hilarious as either, say, the original Ghostbusters or sort of some of Paul Feig's other movies.
Yeah, or Spire. Yeah, or Spire.
Yeah, why it doesn't bother me so much, I have to say, is that I actually really like Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig in this movie. Neither of them are as funny as they have been in other movies. That's absolutely true. But the thing I really like about them is I find them to both be, I mean, you mentioned that they're both likable, and I agree with that. But I also think there's actually a decent attempt in this movie to kind of create a dynamic between the two of them in terms of, in terms of just a quick backstory. They were best friends. They wrote this book together about paranormal activity and how they believed it was real. Kristen Wiig's character, because she's gone, she now teaches at a stuffy university and is worrying about getting tenure, has to kind of distance herself from her past and doesn't want to seem like some sort of kook, whereas Melissa McCarthy's character very much still believes in that stuff. She very much believes the ghosts are real, and so because of that, it drove a wedge between them. I actually like how in the Ghostbusters movie that the movie is some way about them kind of restoring that friendship, which is not that different than what happens in Bridesmaids. It wasn't between those two characters. It was between Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph in that movie. But I actually found that to be really charming, and I know we keep using this word likable, but likable is almost too weak of a word, I would say, because I just really enjoyed the energy of the two of them on screen together. And specifically why I liked it is that for both actresses, these are two of the most normal characters they've ever played mm-hmm. in a mainstream comedy. And I think that's all to the good, especially for Melissa McCarthy, because going back to Spy real fast, one of the reasons why I think Spy is so terrific and why Melissa McCarthy is so terrific in that movie is that Paul Feig did not write the character with her in mind. He assumed that she was so busy with other projects, I can't get her anyway, so I'm just going to write it in this way. And then it just worked out that she had the time to do it. And that movie feels like it was not written for the Melissa McCarthy type. Will and I are both big fans of her, and we'll talk about the John August movie that she was in with Ryan Reynolds called The Nines over and over again, like how great she is in that. And in Spy, she's such a normal person as opposed to like kind of the caricatures that made her a star. And in this movie too, I feel like what I really love about Melissa McCarthy is that she's like the third or fourth most, in quotes, interesting character. But there's such a lovability about this woman who's basically just a big ghost dork and has always been that way. And I just like how modest that character is. And by comparison, I really like how Kristen Wiig, I mean, basically, like, and I actually think she is funny. I think the thing where she's trying to warn the mayor, that whole scene is really, really funny.
But actually, Andy Garcia is a very underrated comedic force in this movie.
Yeah, he's really, and I think he's really good. I think I actually quite liked that. That neither of them, being the two biggest stars of the four main leads, did not worry about, well, I got to have some funny bits in here. I got to have my parts. They actually blend into the ensemble in a really great way.
And I don't have a problem with that, except that there's, I don't see what, I like their interaction, but the rest of the story is like barely there. Like, why are, what do you agree that the villain is like great, like insanely lame?
Yeah, I mean, Matt Zoller cites his piece about the fact that this came out like yesterday, I think, that he represents all of those hating on fanboy type of jerks. Yeah. Is an interesting idea.
That's not the movie.
I mean, here's the thing I'll say. I have talked about this movie. I wrote my review for The New Republic. I've talked about it elsewhere. I never bring up the plot and I never bring up the bad guy. And that's a clear indication of where the movie lacks. I will say, though, I actually like the buildup or the way it ends for a couple reasons. I think it's to Paul Feig's credit that for the most part, this movie doesn't do a lot of cheap, hey, girl power, am I right? Because Paul Feig's career has been about taking what has been stereotypically thought of in Hollywood as male genres. The gross out buddy comedy, the cop movie, the spy movie, the action spy movie, and essentially saying, let's shift the gender and let's have fun with it, but let's not make too big of a deal of the fact that it's a gender switch. And this movie kind of does the same thing where you have, a big sci-fi, big budget action movie, spectacular, that has women as the leads. I think that there's something to be said because I felt it while watching it. There are certain moments when the four of them, strap on their proton packs and are fighting, the ghosts and the bad guys, where I thought, this is actually kind of amazing in a really kind of subtle way that you're actually seeing women as these characters, and the movie doesn't call attention to it, but you notice, oh, this is different. And I want to get to Kate McKinnon a little bit more in a second. But the Kate McKinnon sequence, especially at the end, I think is actually really powerful. I think it's actually very emotional in a way that people, like maybe 20 years from now, won't understand. But when she's essentially like kicking ass and doing all that stuff, that actually feels legitimately like groundbreaking and revolutionary in a way that the movie actually doesn't like pat itself on the back for being, but it just like subtly ends up being that way. And then the final thing I want to say about the ending, I don't want to give anything away, but there is a moment between Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy in the end that I found legitimately moving, that I actually thought was a perfect wrap-up to the story of their friendship and the reason why Kristen Wiig first believed in ghosts and then stopped believing in ghosts and then kind of what happens in the movie. Again, it's not overdone, but it's really, really nicely put in there. I listen, I have a lot of reservations about this movie. Some of the things you brought up, I completely agree with. But I think that there's more to this movie than maybe it's being given credit for. I don't think it's maybe uproariously funny, and I do think that's a flaw in the film. But the sweetness and the gentleness and the fun of the movie is not to be discounted.
I also think some of the... Like, what do you think of the sequence where they go to the rock show and there's some sort of like, I'm sorry, there's like a lot of the action sequences in this, not that I, like, look at Spy. Like, the Spy action sequences are pretty good.
Yes, they
like
are.
They really do hold up. And I feel like a lot of this feels really lame. That scene with the heavy metal concert just feels rough. Like, it feels like it, like, yeah, there's an Ozzy
I don't disagree at all. I completely agree with you.
There's an Ozzy Osbourne punchline in that bit. Yeah. Like,
and especially just real fast when you compare it to the action sequence in Spy where 50 Cent shows up, which is much better.
Yeah, right. And that's the thing, is it just feels like Spy. We've praised Spy tons, but like Spy feels like inspired, but also that self-congratulatory thing that we both agree this movie does not have. Spy doesn't have that either, so I'm glad that's another reason I don't hate this movie. But Spy is also great. Like, Spy feels inspired. Feels like an extra. Spy feels like we're gonna do something really good with this. This feels like, let's not screw this up. And I think because of that, and I don't think they screwed up. Not that Ghostbusters 2 was all that great, or there was this great franchise not to get screwed up. Again, like, I keep coming back to The Watch because that movie really stinks, and that's probably the closest we've come to. I mean, those are big comedic stars. If you were to say 5 years ago, hey, we're doing a Ghostbusters with all dudes, it very well might have been those four guys.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It very well might have been those four guys. So, you know, I think that that speaks, and I think this is a lot better than that movie because there's better people in charge and more talented people and more likable people. I just don't think it justifies the concept. And I just think a lot of the action sequences are surprisingly lame in this, like across the board. Even the scene, there's a scene where there are like big balloons from like the Macy's parade that they just seem to attack out of nowhere and for no real reason other than to once again get a callback to the earlier Ghostbusters movie that I don't think we were really beckoning for all that much. And the last thing I kind of want to say that, and you know, this is one of those movies that, other than the cameo, which I agree is kind of fun, the one good cameo that shows up in the credits, this is definitely a movie you are not rewarded for sticking through the entire credits. The post-credit sequence of this movie actually made me like, oh, come on.
That didn't bother me. Well, put it this way. I think what probably is more accurate to say is that last little button at the end may confirm how you feel about the movie. I think right. You'll either go, it's fine, or you'll be more like you and be like, okay, wait, what? No. Right. I agree. I mean, this movie, this is exactly, I mean, you used a phrase that I mentioned in my New Republic piece, the don't screw it up phenomenon. Right. That is very much what is ironic about this movie, is that as much as these whiny jerks complain and complain and complain about their childhood being ruined, the movie itself is in its own way catering to them. It is actually, in fact, worrying about them. And it is a defect in this movie, I think. I think where Spy is better, among other things, Spy has a script. This movie doesn't have a script. This movie does feel, and we talked about this on other podcast episodes, the thing that I don't like about modern comedy, which is, you know, in big action movies, there's that cliched line of, we'll fix it in post, meaning, well, we'll just put some special effects on this, that'll look fine. But in the world of comedy, the we'll fix it in post kind of means, let's just riff an improv and you're all funny and we'll just stitch it together in the room, in the editing room. You watch scenes in this movie and you go, oh, they didn't know what they were doing, and so they just kind of like put it together. And when you go back and watch Spy, that doesn't happen. Spy has a beginning to end script where it actually works really nicely. And put it this way, if that wasn't the case in Spy, you could have fooled me, because it doesn't play that way when you watch it. Also, this movie doesn't have Rose Byrne, which is also... Right. One last thing I want to say. As somebody who actually likes this movie, I'm in this weird like minority of people who like the movie and defend the movie and sing its praises, but they actually don't like Kate McKinnon that much in this movie. I have to say, she I think is fabulous in SNL. I think she's not used enough on Saturday Night Live. So I'm definitely a huge fan of hers. that character feels a little much to me like, here's a character I conceived. It feels a little bit too like from the world of improv or even from Saturday Night Live, where it doesn't feel... I think that the other three characters, my problem with Leslie Jones as a side note is, hey, Leslie Jones, what's your job? Well, I know a lot about New York, which will be very handy in the exposition to come. That's kind of what, like Leslie Jones doesn't have enough to do in this movie. But Kate McKinnon is sort of the, you're going to be our wild card. So just kind of like exist in your own movie almost and kind of do like your own kind of thing. And I don't mind it, but it does feel like it's, again, to this thing that I'm talking about where the movie feels... stitched together. You've used the word not inspired. I would also say it doesn't feel as confident as I would have liked. There is the sense of bodies like exploding off of each other, but not exactly all working in the same way. I think Chris Hemsworth, this is a better version of his character that he played in Vacation as the dumb hunk guy. But even that does feel a little bit kind of like, and we'll have this and this and this and this, and hopefully it'll all kind of come together. This movie is very hit or miss. I completely agree with that. It hits enough for me that I do recommend it, though.
Okay, so what grade did you end up giving it?
I give it a very solid B.
Okay, and it's funny you mentioned Kate McKinnon because I think she is. I agree with you that it's a little off, but I feel like that they need a lot of the energy that she provides, and she gives the movie kind of this off-kilter energy. But ultimately, I couldn't go. This is not a fun movie to dislike because I like everyone involved so much, and I just frankly feel like it is a good thing that this movie exists. But I ultimately gave it a C.
A C. I think that's. I forgive you.
Thanks, man.
Speaking of movies that we may disagree on, let's talk about Cafe Society.
All right, Cafe Society. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but you and I are somewhat known for being Woody Allen fans. I love the idea, by the way, that we're about to go have a long discussion about a Woody Allen movie right after I panned the all-female Ghostbusters. I'm feeling awesome right now. So Cafe Society is the 46th movie, by the way, directed by Woody Allen. Just wrap your mind around that for a moment. This is his 46th movie, written and directed by Woody Allen. Of course, stars Kristen Stewart, Jesse Eisenberg, Corey Stoll, and Steve Carell. It's about a young writer in the 30s, a Brooklynite in the 30s named Bobby, played by Jesse Eisenberg, who decides he wants to move to New York, to Los Angeles, to try to work for his film executive uncle, played by Steve Carell. He ends up falling in love with Phil is the name of Steve Carell's character, ends up falling in love with Phil's assistant, played by Kristen Stewart, and assistant Vonnie. And while still on back in Brooklyn, his brother, played by Corey Stoll, named Ben, is a mobster who... you know, basically buries people in cement that he disagrees with. This is, and as it turns out, Phil and Vonnie are having an affair. Jesse and Bobby and Vonnie have fallen in love. And there's sort of this kind of lax sort of love triangle going on with it. Now, one thing I mentioned in my review, I reviewed just for the New Republic. One of the things that I feel like is important to remember, you know, we could have a whole podcast about the off-screen stuff of Woody Allen. I think this is not really the place for that. I think we're discussing the movie. I think if you where you stand on Woody Allen, I think particularly this era of Woody Allen, because the argument, I mean, we discussed this on an earlier podcast. We were talking about the movies we're most looking forward to over the summer, and I mentioned how Woody Allen was actually due for one of the movies that everybody liked. It actually had been a while. It's been since Blue Jasmine, and before that, I believe it was Midnight in Paris, and before that, it was Vicky Cristina in Barcelona. About every 3 or 4 years, because people always complain when he makes a You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger or To Rome with Love, these kind of trifling, very small movies. People like say, like, Woody Allen just makes a crappy movie every year and doesn't really care. And then he'll make a really great one, and people, or at least a movie that people perceive as really great, and everyone will get back excited about it again, and then they'll forget that by the next movie. So he's due for one of those, and I'm saying this is not it. Like, I don't think this movie is a bad movie. It looks fantastic, which is something I definitely would like to talk to you about in a bit. It looks fantastic. It's by, can you say the guy's name? It's the guy did Apocalypse Now and Last Tango in Paris.
Yes, cinematographer Vittorio Storaro.
Yeah, the first time they've worked together, the movie just like pops visually in a way that a Woody Allen movie has not actually done in a while. To me, the issue is not so much that these are the same themes that Woody Allen has hit on for a long time. And it's more that The movie, and listen, his movies often tend to be a little slack, even the good ones, even the Cafe, Blue Jasmine, which a lot of people like, still has some moments of kind of slack. But this movie really never builds any sort of momentum at all. It feels like it feels like a pastiche of other Woody Allen movies, all kind of thrown together. There's a lot of good stuff in this movie. I feel like Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart are very good together. I feel like Steve Carell's actually really nice, really good in the movie. He replaced Bruce Willis. It's hard to imagine Bruce Willis playing this character, to be entirely honest. So I think he's good in it. But the whole plot line with the brother is just dropped. it's just dropped like three quarters of the way way through the movie. And the movie doesn't feel followed through the way that Inspire, really, like when he's on his game, like A Midnight in Paris or A Blue Jasmine or Christina Barcelona, when he is feeling like I've got something to say, they feel like they've got that extra oomph in them. I'm not sure this has that extra oomph.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it, too. You know, it's what's hard about Woody Allen movies, as I've discovered. I didn't discover this. Everybody knows this if you're a Woody Allen fan at this point. You kind of can't defend them against people who don't like them. Because, for instance, I talked to a dear friend and colleague the other day about this movie who is kind of just over Woody Allen. And he's like, it's the same themes, it's the same stuff, nothing's different, it's the same thing he's done 10 or 15 times. And that's basically true. And you can't argue anybody out of that at this point. I mean, to me, the argument I have about Woody Allen is the same argument I have with, say, a totally different filmmaker like Terrence Malick. It's like, yes, that's the thing he does. And if you don't like it, I will never be able to convince you otherwise. I think you either sign up for this is another riff on these themes, let's see how he's dealing with these themes this time, or you're just not interested anymore. And I can't begrudge anybody who's not interested anymore. One of the things I do like about this movie is it's a weird movie in that it is weirdly mildly ambitious, but can't decide if it's going to be really ambitious or not.
Yeah, because it can't decide. It sets up ideas and it feels like, oh, if he's revved up, he's going to do this. And then he just kind of doesn't.
Yeah. And so for me, that kind of cuts both ways, I have to say, because right. The one aspect of it that I do like is that it isn't, because a lot of people will obviously call this movie slight or a piffle or a bobble or whatever. And that's not entirely inaccurate, but there's actually, I think, more thought going on into the themes of what's going on of characters trying to make the best of their lives and trying to figure out their lives and then being forced to live with decisions. The thing I really like about this movie is, more so than I think in a lot of his recent movies, Cafe Society is very much about you're at a point in your life where the whole world seems possible. And then you actually have to make a choice. And when you make the choice, the whole world doesn't seem possible anymore. And that changes how you look at your life and how you deal with that. And so, for instance, the whole thing with Corey Stahl as the brother represents another way of being and another way of kind of living in the world that Jesse Eisenberg's character doesn't want to be. But the movie can't exactly entirely figure out how to make that sing. But instead, I think what does work is that when Jesse Eisenberg and that romantic triangle in some ways gets resolved, another sort of thing opens up for the Jesse Eisenberg character involving Blake Lively. I think that whole thing works really well. People have said, well, she's just sort of like the anonymous attractive blonde. I actually think she's better than that in this movie. I think she serves a better purpose than that. And I think this movie actually gets to an ending that's like sneakily poignant in a way in terms of, I mean, Woody Allen's always been very good at characters getting something that you think that they want and not really getting the whole thing. I mean, it goes entirely back to the ending that he wanted for Hannah and her sisters where, you know, Michael Caine's character is still kind of obsessed with the other sister. He's back with Hannah, but he didn't end up doing that ending, and he still kind of laments that he didn't go for it. I mean, this ending kind of is that ending in a way where it's about getting certain things that you want, but not getting everything, and how you kind of that them's the breaks. I mean, one of the things that I like about Woody Allen's movies over the last 10 years is that they are very much about this is the only life that you have. I mean, because he is such a staunch atheist. And especially as he gets older, and I think that this point needs to be made, as he gets older, you watch these movies and you think, these are movies about people with limited time and trying to decide, what will I do with that time? How am I going to handle it if things don't work out exactly? And while that may be a repeated theme, I find it more and more moving as he gets older. You know, Glenn Kenny in his review, which I thought was really, really like spot on Roger Ebert's site, mentioned the fact that, you know, Woody Allen does the narration in this movie. And Glenn Kenny mentioned that Woody Allen actually sounds like a man who's 80 years old.
He sounds tough.
Yeah.
He really does sound tough. I mentioned that in my review as well. Yeah. It sounds raspy and very old.
Yeah, and I've had other people say, yeah, it sounds like it was sort of like a first take. And I'm like, I don't know if that's a first take as much as it's just that's where he is. And, you know, I'm a fan, you're a fan. This will mean more to us than maybe the average moviegoer. There is a poignancy built into this movie. They think it's the same theme, it's the same theme. Yes, but he is getting older and that theme is not going away. And for obvious reasons, it is not going away. So am I reading too much into it? I'll take that as a criticism, but I feel that while watching this movie.
I find it, one thing I do find agreeable about it, it's very unfussy, which I guess will happen when you've made 46 movies, but it's very unfussy. Like it doesn't waste a lot of time on a lot of stuff. The movie never feels slow. But, and to me, that I think you're right. I think you've given a great point about how it feels like an ambition not entirely followed through, because there's a moment in this movie where it feels like the plot lines, particularly the ones with Bobby's family in Brooklyn, and how there's there's the brother and the sister, and they've got their kind of separate plot lines, and they interact, and it feels like it's building up to this thing, and then it just kind of doesn't, which of course may be part of the point, but it also feels like a sketch in a lot of ways more than like a fully realized movie.
Yeah, and to your point though about how great Storaro makes specifically the LA stuff look. If people are saying, well, this is the same old movie, the thing I think that's actually interesting about this movie is this movie actually sells LA as the place to get away. I mean, I think that there's something really nice about this idea of this New York family in the 1930s looking at Los Angeles as a way to escape cold, miserable winters, to escape New York. And it makes LA look like a paradise in a really great way, where you understand why the Jesse Eisenberg character not only kind of falls in love with the city, but also very much falls in love with the Kristen Stewart character. I think Kristen Stewart's really great in this. I would also say, because this also comes up when other people play the Woody Allen character, it seems very intentional to me, and I want to know how you feel about this. It feels very much that the Jesse Eisenberg character at the beginning sounds very Woody Allen-ish, but as he gets more confident as a person, he sounds more and more like Jesse Eisenberg as he goes along. And that seemed intentional to me. I don't know how you felt about it in terms of, is he the Woody Allen surrogate, and how close is Kenneth Branagh-esque does he get in this performance?
I feel like he's, well, you know, he's also in To Run With Love, and I thought he was more Woody Allen-ish in that.
Yes, I agree. I think
you're right. I think there's, you know, I mean, he's a really good actor. Batman, very Superman aside, there is something that he does, even in the early scenes where he's a little, like the scene where he's with the prostitute, and like he's almost a little bit too. You feel the Woody Allen there.
You feel like you're reading a New Yorker story from 50 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. But you don't by the end of the movie.
Yes.
And, you know, I've said this about him even in Adventureland. That's the name of it, right? The one.
With Kristen Stewart. Yeah.
Also with Kristen Stewart. Is that, like, there is a. I know it seems strange to say. I'm not saying he should be an action hero or anything, but there's a muscularity to his performance that I think is underrated. Like, these guys, even when they're petulant and peevish, like, they are fully realized in a lot of ways. And I feel like there's not I like Michael Cera, you like Michael Cera, but back when people used to compare Michael Cera and Jesse Eisenberg, I always felt like it was a comparison that didn't serve Cera well, cuz Eisenberg has got he's at his best when he's playing a confident character, particularly when it's a confident character that probably shouldn't be so confident. And I feel like that is very strong. But I think what works about this movie, particularly in his performance, is toward the end when he's becoming successful and when he's finding his place in the world. It is, you're right, he's a completely different kind of character. And I think works very well, particularly, you know, and I think it works out well too, because sometimes, you know, that Woody Allen character can feel not that self-aware, even in the way that the actor plays him sometimes. It feels, Kenneth Branagh being, of course, the example I always use on this, where it just feels like, not only are you doing a Woody Allen impression, you haven't really thought in it much about this character at all, except to do a Woody Allen impression. And I never get that feeling from Jesse Eisenberg, and I certainly don't get it here. And I think it sets up, actually, the kind of change that that character makes, I think, pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, yes, this is a plot you've seen. You can see it stretching out a mile down the road. You kind of know where it's going, especially in the first half. You know where it's going to go. I didn't know where it was going to go in the second half, though. And I actually did like enough of the kind of the permutations and twists in terms of how, I mean, when Blake Lively shows up, you can kind of guess. But again, I feel like Woody Allen finds some nice kind of grace notes in that movie. I feel kind of the same way about this movie as I do Irrational Man, where if you squint just right, you can see the really good movie that's there, and I am predisposed to squint, you know?
We are
predisposed. So we look for it. That being said, I think that there's something to be said about the fact that, because I have to be honest, I get tired of these pieces written by very smart people who I usually respect, who are like, you know, he's a sham. We've exposed him. Like, you know what? at this point, there's no cultural points in making that argument, first of all. Because, I mean, listen, Will, you and I are Woody Allen fans. We know this is a very lonely hill to die on.
Every year, and we have to do it every year.
Yeah, it's basically like you, me, Richard Brody, and that's kind of about it. So this idea of like these takedown pieces where it's like, aha, we've exposed him. You know what? I think the culture has decided how they feel about Woody Allen, and that's fine. And so even though you and I may be a little more, again, predisposed to read more into it, I think in some ways, he kind of is owed it, because I think a lot of people just kind of look at the surface and go, I've seen this enough. And I think there's more to it than just I've seen it enough.
Right. I agree. So ultimately, what'd you give it?
So after all of that, I give it a B minus.
Yeah, so did I. So there we go. that if in the future, the next time that when the next Woody Allen movie comes out with Jim Belushi, by the way.
Oh, and Justin Timberlake, right?
Yes, exactly. So two people currently popular in the Grierson and Leach conversation. But the when next movie comes out, just remember, here's what's going to happen. Grierson and I are going to have like a 15 to 20 minute conversation where we're like, yes, I know. But there's this idea that hints at something, and there's good stuff going on, and there's this, and this actor's pretty good, and we're both going to say B minus.
Right. Exactly, and by the way, to an earlier point that you made, I like You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, and I will fight anyone otherwise. I think that's I think that's an underrated movie, actually, but yes.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help either of our cases, by the way, me saying that. I acknowledge that.
Hey, people listening to this podcast, next time you see me at a party, ask me what I think about anything else, and I will talk your ear off for the next 45 minutes.
I was going to say, there was a recent, I think it was The Playlist did a ranking of all the Woody Allen movies. I think it was The Playlist, and that movie was dead last, and I'm like,
this is
where Will and I, this is why we don't get invited to anything, because and if you want to hear me talk about Cassandra's Dream, which I like, which Will doesn't like, and I will defend that movie to the ends of the earth.
We should stop.
That anybody married either of us is amazing. Yes.
You're preaching the choir. All right. So that is Cafe Society. B minuses from both of us. So the one thing I want to do very quickly, as I talked about at the beginning of the podcast, is I want to we will not do this again. If I see a movie from the first half of 2016 that I would put on my top six, we will not go back. You'll have to wait to the end of the year podcast to see if that happened. But I did see a movie this week that you talked about in the podcast that I did not get a chance to talk about, that I thought, oh, okay, this is I that was a huge, huge fan of and wanted to put it on my top six. And so I saw it this week, so I just wanted to have a brief little 5-minute conversation about it. Not so much a conversation, but I just wanted to tell you what I thought of it, and then you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong. Though obviously I must be somewhat wrong because it's not on your list.
I can't wait. I love any conversation that starts with, I'm going to tell you why I liked it so much. So
yeah, exactly.
Go for it. Yes, I am very intrigued what this movie is.
So do you have a guess?
I'm not even going to make a guess. I'm just so...
Okay. I don't want you to guess. I'm just wondering if you have
a guess. I have no guess.
You have no guess. Okay, so the movie that I would make my top six that I had not seen until just last week is Sing Street, directed by John Carney, starring Ferdia Walsh-Peele, Lucy Boynton, Jack Rayner, Mark McKenna, Aidan Gillen. It is the story of a, in 1985, a teenager, a kid in Ireland, in Dublin, is kind of a Catholic school where he keeps getting beaten up, and he decides to start a band inspired by a girl. It is every story you've ever seen. It is, in fact, Grierson, almost the exact plot of Catch, my book that I wrote in 2005.
Wait, was this a whole elaborate thing to work in a plug for your book?
It was not. But I have to say, I was like, why am I responding to this plot so much? Oh, yeah, this is the exact same plot of Catch.
I will confess I did not make that connection while watching this movie. But
it
yeah.
is. It's about Irish Britpop rather than baseball. Uh-huh. But there's even the older brother that's had trouble and is stuck at home.
Wow.
Like, it is basically the same movie. But I have to say, this is... Begin Again, which I think was a disappointment. You know how much I love Once.
Yes.
This movie is not as good as Once. It's not as bittersweet as Once. But man, this is, you know, if you've known one thing about me for years of talking to me, I am a sucker for movies like this.
You are a sucker for these types of movies.
I am absolutely a sucker for these type of movies, and this is one of those pure pleasure. I know, like, listen, there's this story never goes in a surprising direction, though I also don't think it's completely candy, cotton candy. Is there's conflict in this movie. It's not just this easy dream fulfillment, but I feel like it, frankly, there were parts of this that reminded me a little bit of Everybody Wants Some ! I think it's got a little bit of that kind of idea. It's a little bit more sentimental, it's a little bit more swoony, but I loved every single minute of this movie. To me, one of the great little moments of this movie, there's a big scene where our couple is running in love out of a gig that he's played, and everybody's cheering, and there's a guy just to the left of the screen puking. and I feel like that is, like, the movie every once in a while will give you a little wink to be like, all right, we know this is set, we know what we're doing here. But there is a scene to me, I don't know if you have a favorite song from this movie or something that you think completely works really well, but the there's this absolutely dazzling sequence in the middle of the movie set to the song of Drive It Like You Stole It, where basically our main character is having this fantasy sequence where in the middle of the lowest point of his life, where after I saw that sequence, I was like, oh, I absolutely love this movie. I wasn't so much on the fence as much as not realizing just how much I was enjoying it. So Sing Street, if you want to know, it would replace Wiener on my list, and the movie I like a lot, but if I had to do that list now, I would drop Wiener, and Sing Street would be on my list.
Well, I agree that Sing Street is better than Wiener, so I approve of this switch. Yeah, I like Sing Street a lot as well. My two things that keep it from making my list was, I think the songs do thin out as the movie goes along. I love that sequence too, the one you described. Yeah. I love that one too. I think the songs in the second half are not as strong, and I think that's actually... It drags the movie a little bit, and there is, to me, a bit of a everything kind of works out. Sort of. I mean, this is not dissimilar to my problem with Brooklyn last year, which we talked about a little bit before we were doing kind of the podcast. There is a little bit of, don't worry, everything is going to work out kind of perfectly wonderfully. And, you know, I don't want to be too harsh about that, but the way it ends... I really love the first half of this, and as it goes along, it feels the magic of it starts to evaporate for me a little bit. But that said, it is a really charming, enjoyable movie. And I know in the main guy, this is like his first lead acting role. He's really charming in it. She's really good in it. It's very fun. It's very fun. If I've been thinking, of course, you would, especially because you liked One so much, you would respond to this movie.
And I did. So just so you know, so now when you go back and listen to that podcast, whenever I start talking about Wiener, just go play this part again. Or just go Sing Street. Watch Sing Street, because you can watch it on streaming, on iTunes, and I believe on demand right now. So go see Sing Street. Even though Grierson is not in your top six, you would certainly recommend people to go see it.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so now it is our reboot section. This week we talk about the film Gattaca from 1997, starring Ethan Hawke, Jude Law, Uma Thurman, Lauren Dean, Gore Vidal. I forgot this was around the time where Gore Vidal was showing up in a lot of movies.
Yes.
And he was in Bob Roberts and showing up. And directed by Andrew Niccol. This is right after The Truman Show, correct? Or is it right before The Truman Show?
This,
right after.
This was after, I'm pretty darn sure, yes.
Yeah. Yes. So this was his directorial debut, of course, and he wrote The Truman Show. This is about basically I kind of love, by the way, that the movie actually starts with the title pull in the not too distant future. I was like, wait, you can't just say that. That's the thing that we say to make fun of these type of movies. But in the not too distant future, a man named Vincent, played by Ethan Hawke, in Future Society, which I guess would be now, because this was 20 years ago.
Oh, shoot. Is that happening now?
Oh, no. Wow. No wonder we suck. We're live births. In the Future Society, all children are basically have all genetic anomalies frittered away, and they're able to become like these super people, I guess. And basically, Ethan Hawke, who is a live birth, basically takes the personality of Jude Law's Jerome Mora, who's been in a car accident and therefore is not able to move his legs, and uses his identity to get in to be allowed to have the opportunity to become an astronaut, which he's not allowed to do otherwise. I'm doing a poor job of describing the plot, but basically the idea is he is in the special academy that he has to keep hiding the fact that he is, in fact, of natural birth and therefore does not have all of these inherent, not so much advantages, but statistical probabilities of a lack of weakness. He meets Uma Thurman, who's also there, and there's a murder, and Alan Arkin shows up, and there's all sorts of madness in there. Grierson, did you see, I don't think I'd seen Gattaca in since it came out, had you?
I had not, and real fast, because I would be this person listening to the podcast right now, yelling at the two of us. In fact, Gattaca came out the year before The Truman Show came out.
Oh, all right.
And by the way, that was, I had to look it up because I was sure that you were right, but it turns out Truman Show 98, Gattaca 97. No, I actually had never seen Gattaca until this week, watching it for the podcast. Yeah.
So first two questions. One, do you want, because this movie seems to have helped. There are people that still think very fondly of this movie. I think it's seen by some as being a little ahead of its time, talking about things that we'd be talking about years later. Did you see why that was the case? And two, did you like it?
Kind
of the first one or kind of the second?
Kind of the first one and not really the second. Really, as a really fast side note, you know, in terms of movies that are like critic proof, I haven't seen Equals yet, the Kristen Stewart, Nicholas Holt movie. I've heard from 1,000 different critics that movie is not good. I am going to watch that movie. And the reason why I'm going to watch that movie, you were talking before about Sing Street kind of being up your alley. Movies about the not too distant future where like humans are perfect, but they're like emotionally like neutered. That's my jam, apparently. I just love those types of movies. So in theory, Gattaca would be my type of movie. In general, with this kind of film, though, I think that, and of course, if you'd seen it at the time, you know, maybe I would feel differently, but I sort of feel like either the story's got to be really great, or the atmosphere, the mood, the look of your movie has to be so spot on that I don't care. And neither of them exactly work for me in this. I mean, you know, with Andrew Niccol, it's like, I mean, this is sort of like his domain, is sort of writing about this idea of future-ish or slightly twisted societies. They're very much comments on the chilling aspects of modern life. Truman Show is very much that way. Gattaca is very much that way. There are elements of this movie in terms of its construction that I like. I actually like how they get around the problem of he isn't looking anything like Jude Law. And like, well, nobody's going to look because they just assume. And I actually really like that. That didn't seem like a cop-out. That seemed really smart, and I like that. But this, to me, is one of those movies that is, okay, I hope you're ready for the things we're going to tell you about the way society is. But be warned, it may blow your mind. And I'm like, well, it's not really blowing my mind. Like it's right. I mean, I think the score by Michael Nyman is really cool. I think the cinematography, the look of it is decent, but this is a movie that thinks in the future, everybody who's a detective is going to wear that type of hat. You know right. what I mean? Like it feels like that kind of retro future thing yeah. where is, and listen, I have a lot of respect for filmmakers who try to figure out the future because that's damn hard. It's like you can have something like Minority Report where I think it still holds up really, really well in terms of how it looks. And then you have other things like this where it definitely feels like a very conscious choice of a certain era of filmmaking. And that stuff felt like, oh, this seems like the easy choice in terms of how to do it. I mean, this is not a super big budget movie, so it's not like they had millions and millions of dollars, but you can still kind of, I mean, to use like a random example, like Moon, that movie didn't have a lot of money, clearly, and they were able to make that look pretty damn impressive in terms of like the moon base and all of that. This one, it feels very borrowed from whether it's THX 1138 or other types of movies like that, where it's everything is kind of sleek. And everybody has the kind of hair that nobody I don't care how long we live, Will, no one's hair is going to look like that unless we're in a movie. And I don't want to be too much of a dick about this stuff, but to me, those are the types of things that to me are meant to be profound or interesting, and they're just kind of okay. Like they don't translate as being, I mean, like a movie I was actually thinking of, like Never Let Me Go, which I absolutely love. Right. Like even like that movie doesn't overly fuss over what will the future look like. Right. But it has such a, like a feel to it that you're completely convinced. I found myself not being entirely convinced by the world that he had constructed in this movie.
Yeah. Also, why does this movie need a murder plot? Like, I understand why that gets him closer to being discovered. But the whole, like... the idea of, not to give away a spoiler for a movie that's 20 years later, but turns out that it's his brother, which seems like quite a coincidence, actually. But then it's a weird Alan Arkin performance. Like, it's a very kind of strange... The whole murder plot doesn't really work. The whole love story, I don't think, really works with Uma Thurman either, because she's not really that much of a character. It just kind of nods at her being a character. And to me, that I feel like the setup for this movie... Basically, it's like 10 minutes where we kind of introduce to the world, and then we get like a 20 minutes of getting the narration of what this world is and who it is. And I feel like that first half hour is very solid. I think it's when people think of Gattaca, that's probably what they think of. They think of this future world and the way that they deal with genetics and so on. But they don't think of the clunker of a plot that the movie kind of gets inserted into. And to me, I'd seen it a long time ago, and I don't remember. I never loved this movie. But certainly, when I thought of it, I thought, oh, yeah, that was a movie that may have been a little ahead of its time with the way that it kind of talked about science fiction and kind of looked at picking and choosing what you might want out of your children and so on. But, man, the plot is really, really clunky. And it feels like a nod to some sort of film noir that it never follows through on and then never really does much with.
Yes, and even that is not, to my mind... deeply original. It's like, well, marry sci-fi and film noir. Okay, yeah. That's been kind of done.
That's done in every sci-fi movie.
That's like the Blade Runner model. I mean, there's so many different movies like that. I just, while watching it, I thought, it's funny that you brought this up in the first question you asked. I know this has sort of a cult following. I would respectfully suggest that I think most sci-fi movies that aren't hits end up getting a cult following, because there's just a certain group of people who will feel that there are interesting ideas. And I agree, there are interesting ideas in this and will want to stick up for it. But I don't think the movie holds up. The thing I think that is actually the strongest in the movie, and it's so weird how it gets back to this, is the idea of like brotherly rivalry and the idea of, you know, it's so funny that the guy who wrote the very nice review and so kind of like wizardly incorporated the plot into the description of the two of us. This idea of, like, essentially he is the Danny DeVito character in Twins. That he is, like, he's the other one who his parents kind of didn't want and are not entirely proud of. And how you live with that and then being essentially pursued by your brother and having this confrontation that ends up with them swimming. I will say that there is a line. I mean, this movie's 20 years old, so is this a spoiler? There is a line when the two of them are actually swimming at the end, and Ethan Hawke wins that swimming competition. Mm-hmm. There is a nice line in that movie that I thought to myself, wait, did I miss an arc? And I actually, like, for a brief second kind of doubted that and kind of thought back, but I thought, no, and you mentioned it very nicely. There's too much plot busyness in this movie, and it makes me wonder if the plot was something that helped get this movie made, where it's like, okay, well, it's like a, you know, it's got this like murder mystery thing, like, oh, okay, you know, it's not too heady. There's still kind of like a simple mainstream kind of plot in this thing, so people can follow in. There's a love story too, but it's funny how the movie feels like it wants to be about these two brothers, but it's only at the beginning and the end. One other thing I have to say, by the way, is that as a longtime Ethan Hawke defender and supporter, this to me is not a great Ethan Hawke performance. And it's only a couple years after the first of the Before movies with Richard Linklater. So he was still doing good stuff at this time. But it's funny how I watched it and thought, I kind of wonder what he would do now. There's something that's almost a little too, it's almost like the youngish, less compelling Ethan Hawke that's kind of front and center in this movie, I feel like.
It feels like he's trying to do a movie star thing in a way that he's usually undercutting that.
Yes, that's actually a great way of putting it, Will, because there is that sense of, like, I don't know, assign motives to why people do things, but this does feel like a movie where it's like, hey, this is like a type of, like, it's a smart, like, movie you can do, but it's going to show that you're a star. And it's also kind of funny to see Jude Law in this during the, like, period of time where it's like, oh, Jude Law is going to be like the next big thing and like that. I'm not sure if anybody really, though it is funny to see both Maya Rudolph and Dean Norris of Breaking Bad fame.
I love Dean Norris. Dean Norris is, I was like, wow.
Yeah, that was a rewind it because I missed that. Oh, wait, yeah. It is in fact Dean Norris. I'm just not sure that anybody necessarily shines exactly in this movie. I mean, I've been kind of harsh on it. I didn't hate it, but it was one of those movies where I felt like, because I had never seen it and I was sort of curious, it felt better forgotten as opposed to, oh, people really had missed the boat on this and this really was kind of ahead of its time. It did not feel that way to me while watching it.
I agree. So thank you, Scoot Diggity, for your very clever.
Yeah, I would say in terms of our reviews, this was a 5-star one as far as I'm concerned, in terms of
a terrific review, just the movie. I'm with you. I found myself pretty underwhelmed by it. So, all right, Grierson, so that is the podcast this week. We'll see how I produced all these things together. I got out, if I did not get out all the horrible things that you said, and I mean, like, truly, like, wretched, offensive, I mean, I got them out. I have to save your career. I must have edited them out.
I really appreciate that. I can't even tell you.
I got to figure out how to do that. All right. So this is the podcast. We remind you, as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a nice review. Always helps people find the podcast. And please let us know, by the way, email us either at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic, or you can also just email us personally. What email address do you prefer people email you at,
Grierson? The old Hotmail account, Grierson@Hotmail.com, actually. That's the...
If you want to know how old we are, mine is WilliamFLeach@Yahoo.com. So tell us about this Google Mail that people are using. I think that'll be kind of a fascinating thing. People can email us. Tell us what you think of the audio of the podcast, if it sounds good, if you have any suggestions or so on. So next week, Grierson, we got two more movies coming out and one reboot. The big movies next week are Star Trek Beyond, which is from the old TV show.
Gunsmoke, right?
Gunsmoke, yes. And then we'll be talking about Don't Think Twice, directed by Mike Birbiglia. I can never say the name right. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. Okay. Yeah.
Mike Birbiglia is starring Keaton Michael Peel. You know who I'm talking about. All sorts of people. It's about the improv world. I'll be reviewing that for the site. Grierson will be reviewing Star Trek Beyond for us. And then our reboot next week is The Proposition, which is a 2005 movie starring Guy Pearce, directed by John Hillcoat, written by Nick Cave. also starring Ray Winstone. Danny Houston. I'm excited to see a Danny Houston movie because this is one of my favorite things about Grierson.
I didn't even realize this when I gave the blessing for the proposition. Yes, go ahead.
Randomly, I really still don't quite understand why Grierson hates Danny Houston.
Like, this is a great to be continued for next week. I don't hate Danny Houston. We'll get into it next week on the podcast.
It's so funny. It's just this like perfectly fine little character actor, and it just drives Grierson crazy. So anyway, we'll be talking about The Proposition on our reboot section, along with Star Trek Beyond and Don't Think Twice. So Grierson, we'll see how this goes. Thanks for coming around. I'm going to go now and go try to go cover this convention in Cleveland. So that should be interesting.
Yes, be safe out there. Be careful.
What could possibly go wrong? America's totally in a nice place right now. Everybody's calm and chill.
No, Will, it's not actually.
I should leave this room more. All right, Grierson, have a great week. We will talk next week on the Grierson Leash podcast. Be safe.